Explore the night skies with our large range of high-quality telescopes. Whether you're a novice or an astronomy expert, we have the right telescope for you in our Australian Geographic e-store. Explore the whole range and find the right telescope for you today. Go to australiangeographic.com.au/shop. That's australiangeographic.com.au/shop. Hi, I'm Chrissy Goldrick and this is Talking Australia, a podcast by Australian Geographic. Today I'm talking to Dr. Sylvia Earle. Sylvia is a living legend of ocean exploration. She's been a marine scientist and explorer for 7 decades. She's a Rolex testimonial, an innovator, and a powerful voice for the plight of our oceans. So I'm honoured to be able to welcome Dr. Sylvia Earle to Talking Australia. And we couldn't be in a more appropriate location for today's podcast as the sound of Sydney Harbour laps against the shoreline at this sailing club in Rushcutters Bay. It's my great honour to welcome Dr. Sylvia Earle to Talking Australia. Welcome, Sylvia.
Oh, I'm so pleased to be here.
Thank you. And now we're in Australia. You've been here probably for about 24 hours. So thank you very much for making the time to be on Talking Australia. We really do appreciate it.
That's my pleasure,
really. It's a really special moment for us at Australian Geographic. Now, Sylvia, you're a passionate advocate for our oceans as the primary driver of all life on Earth and of our need to understand this and to act to protect the oceans. How are we doing right now?
We could do a lot better, that's for sure. We're doing better than we have been in the past, but we really have to hurry. We're running out of time.
Now, you explain the role of the oceans so eloquently, and you do it in terms that people really understand. So can you tell us a little bit about what role the ocean does play in our lives?
Well, when I was a child, we did not know what is now known and knowable. So I've been a witness to this time of great exploration, discovery, but I've also been a witness to a time of tremendous loss. And why should that matter if we've lost half the coral reefs? What if the Great Barrier Reef should just disappear, as it is, seems to be on the way to doing right now? What if we continue the decline of fish in the sea, the sharks, and all the other amazing creatures there? We've already been responsible for losing on the order of 90% of the sharks, the tunas, swordfish, going down the list. I mean, they're still there. There's still reason for hope. But why should we care? Because the natural world keeps us alive. We did not create the planet. We inherited what has taken 4.5 billion years to turn from a fiery rock in a very hostile universe to what we think of as home, a place that we take for granted. But what we are beginning to see, and it's high time that we did, that the ocean is the key. It's, first of all, the water, but it isn't just the water, it's the living ocean. We could have Earth with the ocean if it's just water, and we still could not survive here. It's taken a long time just to create the atmosphere that is hospitable for us, converting it from what was largely a carbon dioxide atmosphere into what we have now. Mm-hmm. Take a breath. Mm-hmm. More than half of the oxygen that we breathe comes from small creatures and some of the seaweeds and larger creatures too, like the seagrass meadows and such. But not only do the photosynthetic organisms in the sea produce oxygen in the sea, but spills off into the atmosphere that we require. And it didn't just happen overnight, but in a sense, it's been almost overnight, like 4.5 decades or so, to unravel some of those systems that have taken so long to get into a place that it all works for us, you know?
And Sylvia, you've been diving in the oceans, as I said before, for seven decades, since the 1950s. So at what stage did you become aware that, I mean, you began as a marine biologist, as a marine scientist, but now you're regarded as one of the great explorers and conservationists. But at what stage in that time did you first become aware that there were problems starting to arise in our oceans that were, you know, caused by the impact of us humans and our behavior?
As a child, I accepted the common thought that the ocean was too big to fail, that it's so large and so resilient, there's nothing humans could do that could possibly harm the ocean. But I've just been a steady witness to the change that has come about literally in a few decades. Taken so long to get Earth just right for the likes of us and life as we know it. But what people haven't quite taken to heart, although the knowledge is there, it's all around us, that we are, let's say Earth is a miracle. Look around, look at the stars, look at the other planets. Not a very hospitable universe out there. And the existence of life on Earth at all seems miraculous, given the odds of all those other places that are beautiful, but they are not habitable. It's the ocean that is the starting point, water, when, as those who look for life elsewhere in the universe, what do they look for first? Water, find the water. And there's plenty of water out there, but what so far has eluded all that looking is the existence of life anywhere else. We've got the perfect place, the distance from the sun. We have a protective magnetic field. We have the ocean. And we have all the time that has gone before the present. I mean, if we were aliens looking for a place to set up housekeeping, and landed on Earth 1 billion years ago, we'd find lots of life on Earth, but it would be entirely microbial, little bitty things. It took until the atmosphere had reached the point of oxygenation through hundreds of millions of years of the results of all that microbial work, if you will, capturing carbon, generating oxygen, generating food, whatever. But finally, we have a place that works, and it's taking us such a short time to cut great swaths through the elements that keep us alive. And the knowledge is there to see the climate, what we're doing, with our eyes wide open, burning fossil fuels. We know what the problems are, and that's a great good start. If you don't know what the problems are, it's hopeless. But we do know, and I do see cause for hope. People are taking action. They're aware of what we're doing, and it's just happening faster than we are taking action.
Yeah, and going back to those early days, and when you first began to, when you first found your passion for the ocean, how did that come about? Were you brought up by the sea? Is it something that you went into as a child and were fascinated?
Well, I was introduced to the ocean when I was about 3 years old, but we did not live near the ocean until we moved to Florida when I was 12. My backyard was the Gulf of Mexico. Mm. It was a great place to be a kid. Many have a backyard in a city. Some have a forest or a desert or whatever, but my backyard, my home, next where my family lived, my other home was the ocean. And I could find things out there just by observing and looking as a kid that I could not find in books. I asked, wanted to know what is that fish? What is this crab? What's going on out here? And I could not find answers. But I found them for myself. Mm. That's the nature of being an explorer. You ask questions and then you look for evidence. You just figure it out.
And did you, that was would have been really the early days of scuba as well. So what was your first, I mean, your first sort of way of getting under the water and staying down there? Did you, was it the, sort of like the gear that we see today, or was it pretty rudimentary?
My first experience breathing air underwater was not with scuba. It was with a copper diving helmet that my brother and his friend, who was the son of a sponge diver, my brother and his friend borrowed it from the sponge diver dad, and we went off to a river. I was the kid sister who tagged along and had the chance to put this helmet over my head and jump into the river, and I went down thinking that I was going to see fish. And what happened is the fish came over to see me. That was a real jolt of my first awareness that fish are curious. Mm. They're individuals, and you know, they're like so many living things that we know on the land, but we just have developed a habit of thinking about fish as something to eat, as commodities. But I had a very early exposure to fish as curious creatures. I went to look at them and found them looking at me. Mm-hmm. It was a year later that I tried scuba for the first time. It was 1953. And I was privileged to be among the first in my country, in the United States, to have access to some of those early double hose regulators that a professor at Florida State University acquired two sets, and we had two words of instruction: breathe naturally, jump in, see what it's like. And it was really amazing. I still get that little jolt of pleasure knowing I can breathe underwater. I can be like a ballet dancer, stand on one finger and do barrel rolls, but mostly I enjoy being able to stay. It's the gift of time, literally.
Staying under the water.
Yes. First. You know, I think about those who explore the land and get to know, whether it's elephants or Jane Goodall with chimpanzees or George Schaller with pandas or others. They live with the animals that they get to observe. They get to know the ecosystem. They stay not just for days, weeks, months, years, but to be underwater. I have lived underwater now on 10 different occasions. That is to go and stay in an underwater laboratory, but not years. I'm lucky to have a few days, a week, 2 weeks underwater, where you can actually day and night get to know individual fish. And you can do that going in and out with diving in a place repeatedly, but there's something about, you know, sleeping underwater and being there when and going out at night to the same places you've been at day by day, getting to see where the fish sleep and where they come out. I mean, some of them are awake at night, others tuck in, and they go to the same places, just as I do. I go to my bed, they go to theirs. And they have, I want to say, companions, buddies, whatever. You can see the relationships if you're there long enough.
Yeah,
that's personalities. Like,
that's what it gives you, I guess, that, because we think of scuba
perspective.
Diving as being a short-term thing, but you, to take you back to that, you, I suppose, came first into the public consciousness as the result of a living underwater experiment or expedition, whatever you want to call it. And that was back in 1970. I think it was about the same time as we were putting men on the moon.
You all
took
men.
All men. And you took a group of all women to live under the sea for 2 weeks. Tell us about that that expedition experiment, that achievement of yours.
Well, NASA was very much a part of that expedition, and there were 10 teams in all. They did not expect women to apply, but some of us did. And the director of the program, James Miller, had to decide whether or not to accept women. And legend has it that he said, well, half the fish are female. I guess we can put up with a few women. And instead of letting us work with our male colleagues, the idea of men and women living underwater together at that time was just not going to be considered appropriate. So they decided to create, out of those who had applied, with male partners in the original application, but they said, well, we'll make a women's team. And they asked me to lead that team. So I got to be in the on the hot seat more often than not as the leader of the team. I was asked to address Congress. I was asked to speak on behalf, not just of the women's team, but the whole program, because it just caught the public's imagination. There were no women astronauts. It was 15 years before women were allowed to do what they should have been doing all along, because if you think of all the competent scientists and pilots who were certainly well qualified, but they just weren't men. But they said after the fact, and they waited until years after the fact, they said, you know, because of the success of the women living underwater during the Tektite project, it really did open the door for women to become astronauts. NASA wanted to know how people would behave, men and women, living underwater in what they regarded as a hostile environment. We didn't think of it as hostile at all, but that was the theory, that you were in isolation. And they made a point of not letting us be in contact with others except by voice. And we had television monitors so that we were being watched 24 hours a day.
Oh, really?
And notes were being taken. The psychologists had a field day. And we could watch the watchers while they were watching us. And the fish were watching us, too. They were looking through the windows. But the results were that women got along really exceedingly well. Everybody predicted we wouldn't, but we did. And we've actually spent more time in the water than any of the guys. That wasn't intentional. It was just that we had projects that were, well, we thought, isn't that why we're here? To spend time out in the water using the ocean as a laboratory? And we did. And yet, we couldn't resist calling the women aquanauts, aqua babes, aqua bells, aqua chicks, aquanauties.
Right. Oh, dear.
But actually, we didn't care what they called us so we could get to go.
Yeah, it's a sign of the times, I guess, and things have moved on.
Think about it. Yeah, I think we haven't totally moved on, not by a lot, but we're getting a whole lot better. There are women oceanographers now in some cases, equaling the number of male colleagues and as students. There are women captains of oceanographic vessels. I was the first woman to be a chief scientist at NOAA, but subsequently it got to be a thing. The chief scientist of who succeeded me at NOAA was a woman and an astronaut, Kathy Sullivan, who later became administrator of NOAA. And Jane Lubchenco became administrator of NOAA. So things did begin to shift, and they continue to shift. But just as we need to shift our attitude about nature generally, to look at the whole world with new eyes, now that we know what we know, I'm cautiously optimistic.
I'm glad to hear you say that. But and so, I mean, what you've touched on there is you are a role model. You're a role model for women, apart from being a role model for people who actually really want to do something about the Earth. So well, how important is that to you, and how does that manifest itself in your life and everything that you do from day to day?
Well, I figure if I can inspire kids to think, well, if she can do it, and I don't mean just girls, I mean boys too, if she can do it, Why can't I? Mm. And that's what I hope will happen. I'm not superwoman or man, super person. I'm, you know, not especially tall or especially strong. Strong-willed maybe, but anybody can do that if you have the gumption to just do it. Mm. I think I was fortunate as a kid to have parents who did not discourage me from my vision of wanting to be a scientist. It's so easy for adults to impose their will and to crush the talents and the natural gifts that their children have because they think that there's something that they ought to be doing instead of what the children have a passion for. So I, you know, everybody has a gift, everyone. Mine may be curiosity.
Mm. And a gift for communication, of course. I mean, I guess that's what happened after the Tektite, is that you really did become a spokesperson for ocean exploration. And over the next few years, you did pioneer underwater exploration in terms of both the technology and just, I suppose, the idea of it. But, I mean, the ocean is still relatively unexplored, isn't it? It's still a great sort of frontier of exploration that we've never really quite broken through in quite the same way that, you know, we've put so much money and research and time, and I suppose even our imaginations fly at the idea of outer space. But the same isn't really said for the deep ocean. So why do you think that might be?
I had lunch once with a great American stateswoman, Claire Booth Luce, who's a playwright too. She loved the ocean. She was a scuba diver. And over lunch at her home in Hawaii, the question came up, why don't you just ask, why do we put so much effort and such a commitment to exploring the skies above? And she said, well, you know, I think it's simple, my dear, looking up at the puffy white clouds drifting by and that blue sky. She said, people think heaven is up there and you know it's in the other direction.
And you do know that, of course, so, because you spend so much time down there.
But that's heaven.
Oh, yes, it is.
It is. Yeah. I mean, my heaven is down.
And you pioneered you've been involved in the development of submersible craft.
Yes.
and things like that, and you walked on the bottom of the ocean. You were the first person to spend a long time sort of in a suit walking along the bottom of the ocean in the late 1970s. So tell us how that came about, and what did you discover when you went down there and did that experiment?
When I was, I think, 13 years old, I read a book called Half Mile Down by William Beebe, where he described his experience teaming up with an engineer, Otis Barton, to develop the first bathysphere, and was able to be a witness of what life is like a half mile under the surface off the coast of Bermuda. And his descriptions of the creatures who live there and in the dark. And most of life on Earth lives in the deep sea, in the dark, below 1,000 meters, below 1,000 feet, you know? And he just whet my appetite, so to speak, that I really wanted to do that. And so having a chance years later as a scientist to team up, as William Beebe did, with engineers to foster the development of technologies to go deep, go deep, go deep, and see life that really is so extraordinary. The diversity exceeds anything on all of the land put together, the diversity of the major divisions of life. And I knew that as a kid. You could see creatures in the sea that you never see anywhere in freshwater on the land. I mean, it works in reverse too, but I mean, whole categories of life. Like, you ever see a starfish on the land or in freshwater? No. All of the echinoderms, they're all in the ocean. And more than 15 of the major categories of life are found only in the sea, and all the other major categories are also there. So it's just glorious. And I, had to get down there and working with engineers to develop technologies so that, selfishly, I could go. Mm. It's hard. A lot of kids would like to not only go up in the skies above, but they too would like to explore the ocean. But how do you do that? How do you get a submarine? Mm. And I had to figure out how to, we did it by starting a company to build underwater equipment that would pay the bills so that we could build a submarine so we could go explore the ocean. And succeeded in actually developing and producing three little submarines. And one of those is still in existence, and it was used for the BBC's Blue Planet series. So that dive off Antarctica, where they went down and found coral reefs 1,000 meters in the darkness along the edge of the ice. So I had a certain sense of pride knowing that that little submarine had my fingerprints on it. But I'm hoping to put fingerprints on a lot more so that kids can go, so that teachers, moms and dads, CEOs, fishermen, let's go down and see what the fish are doing down there, not just dead fish. Not just fish on your plate, but all of the creatures of the sea. Let's go get to know them. Let's have that gift of time so that in depth, dive into time, dive into the history of life on Earth. That's really what I hope to be around long enough to see happen. Deep Hope, we're calling those little submarines.
We'll take a quick break and be back in a moment. We have a special offer for all our listeners. Subscribe to our AG magazine for 6 months for just $30 and save 33% on the newsstand price. That's three issues of our award-winning magazine delivered to your home for just $30. Plus, you'll receive exclusive benefits, including 10% off all our products purchased in our e-store. So don't wait. Go to australiangeographic.com.au/talkingaustralia for our special offer. That's australiangeographic.com.au/talkingaustralia. By the time we're sort of getting to like the 1980s, your exploration is starting to become part of, or conservation is becoming part of exploration. You became a National Geographic explorer in residence, and you became a Rolex testimony.
Yes.
And those kind of partnerships that you had with those organisations, how did they facilitate for you what your mission then became? Because it sort of broadened out, really, didn't it? And it started to become, it's that combination of exploration which brings knowledge of what's actually really happening out there, which isn't always a good story. What was the kind of transition for you? We're going to, you know, come full circle in a little while and talk about your Mission Blue. And there's like the beginning of that journey between the Sylvia Earle, the explorer, and Sylvia Earle, the ocean conservationist.
It's just natural when you see, as a witness, things that others don't see. I mean, I have the privilege of spending thousands of hours under the surface. I've used more than 30 different kinds of submarines. Mm. And you can't, I mean, look at the astronauts. When they come back, they pull people off the street and say, I wish I could take you where I go, where I've been. I want you to see what I've seen. And that's how I feel too. I want everyone to experience that time of discovery, to connect who we are with the rest of life on Earth. And it's mostly under the sea. We think of the ocean as some distant place. We think of fish as food, and certainly fish can be eaten, but they're worth so much more alive than on your plate. And I've come to see that by getting to know them. People used to eat wild birds as a source of groceries. And in some places, they still are taken that way, but mostly people have come to respect the creatures that they've gotten to know. And we have to get to know the creatures in the sea. Mm. We made that choice in the 1980s with whales. Most of the countries around the world, most people see whales with new eyes now that they have had the opportunity to witness that they have families, they have personality, they have social structure, and they are connected to our well-being, that their role in the ocean is part of the ecosystem of which we too are a part. But we are newcomers. They set the stage. And if we take them off the stage, we have diminished the capacity of the planet to function in our favor. And it isn't just whales and fish. It's like a whole coral reef systems that are under siege right now. Why? Look in the mirror. We're the causative agent. You see, that transition for me was so natural. You can't not see something and then say something about and try to share the view. Mm. And not everybody wants to go get in the ocean. I don't know why they don't, but a lot of people still stay on the shore. But if we can share the message, if you will, and encourage them to go see for themselves and make it easy. You know, some people just don't like to get wet unless it's in a shower or bathtub. So, okay, well, come get into a little submarine. Let's go fly in the ocean. Let's go sit at 1,000 meters under the sea and look around at the galaxy of life. And you can not get wet. You can wear what you like. You can take a sandwich.
It's a nice thought.
A bottle of wine.
Now, look, in 2009, you did a TED Talk, and that TED Talk sort of brought your message before a much broader and wider audience than probably you'd had before that. Tell us about what changes, what influence that moment had on you, and where you went next in your extraordinary life, Sylvia.
I was asked to make a wish big enough to change the world. That was the TED Prize. They give a little bit of money, but what they really give you is the opportunity to make a wish, and then the TED community, and they invite people all over the world to make that wish come true. And one man in the audience came up afterwards, and he said, you know, I hadn't thought about the ocean so much before, but I think I get it. If we fail to take care of the ocean, nothing else matters. Mm. And he wrote a check for $1 million on the spot, which made possible an expedition. It was with the National Geographic. We called it TED at Sea. And we went to the Galapagos with about 100 scientists, leaders, communicators, teachers, you know, people who were charged with, let's see what we can do to make the wish come true. My wish was to ignite public support to develop a network of marine protected areas with new communication, you know, do what we're doing right now, harness the value, the power of the web, to have new submarines to explore, and the goal to have places around the world, a network of hope spots, a network of hope, if you will, marine protected areas large enough to save and restore the blue heart of the planet, the ocean. And now, this is 10 years later, more than 120 places with community support have come into existence with champions who are committing to doing what they can to ignite public support, to really develop this network of hope. And Rolex has been a champion and helped to make this dream come true, this wish come true. And National Geographic has been involved. But what really counts is people responding, because you can make rules, you can draw lines on a map, you can make laws, but if people are not on board, they'll do what they like anyway.
And the involvement of the local communities in those places that are identified as hope spots is very important to you, isn't it? That
everything it's essential. Right here in Sydney, just this past year, the coast around here has been established as a hope spot. Mm. And that's just the beginning. It's like planting seeds, and then it's the people of an area who will make the wish come true. And it's got to be their wish, their desire, to give back to the ocean. The ocean has given us life. Mm. It's given us prosperity. Everything we care about really anchors back to having a planet that keeps us alive. Fundamentally, that's the headline. We have to keep the planet alive now. Mm. The Rolex Perpetual Planet is really focused on that very theme.
Now, I was very fortunate to be in Mexico with you.
Oh, yes.
Courtesy of Rolex, just over a year ago, at one of your wonderful hope spots in the Sea of Cortez in Mexico, and I actually went out on a boat with you, so I've seen you in the water. And what I did notice about going out on the boat with you, Sylvia, is that while we were all faffing around getting ready to get in the water, you already gone into the water and before anybody had even noticed. You were so quick off that boat into the water, and it was very clear to me that that is just somewhere that you're completely at home. So these days, how often do you dive? How often do you get into the water? Not often enough.
Right. And I now feel driven to try to get others into the water, to see for themselves. Really, I spend hundreds of days a year on the road, more time in the air than under the sea, unfortunately. But it's, I feel I have to. I can't not do it. But I do get wet somewhere at least once a month, I have to say.
I'm glad to hear it. Well, look, you're here in Australia on a visit to Australia. So will you, on this trip, get a chance to go up to the Great Barrier Reef?
Not this time. I will salute as I fly by. Then I will come back, I promise, myself. Yeah. Not the reef doesn't care whether I'm here or not, but I care. Because I've been a witness since the 70s of the changes that have taken place. And I also do see reasons for hope. It's not gone. And we have the power, we humans, we have superpowers that come from that most important thing of knowing. If we didn't know, we'd be helpless. We continue doing the same stupid things that we've done in ignorance throughout our history, consuming nature, not mindful of what the real cost is to our future. But now we know, and that's good news. And that's why around the world there are movements underway. The United Nations says we have to protect 10% of the ocean by next year, 2020. Well, that's a good start. Others, and I'm on board for this with Mission Blue, 30% by 2030. It's going to be a stretch at our present rate, but we have to do better than that. There's a major movement that says we've got to do at least half of the earth for nature, at least half. But that's like saying, I want to protect half of my heart. Why not look at all of nature with respect? Having small areas or big areas is really important. We need those special places. But we have to treat all of the living world and all of our fellow humans with dignity and respect. None of it is expendable. None of it is a luxury. We need to revise the way we think about who we are, where have we come from, and where might we be going. If we continue down the track that we've been following, it is not a nice picture. But we have the power to choose. That's the gift of being a human. And so that's why I spend a lot of time traveling and meeting with people, going to try to work with those who have the power to make a difference, and certainly doing my best to inspire kids to see their superpowers of knowing and to use it to make the world a better place for them and for everyone who follows.
Well, thank you, Sylvia. It's a wonderful message. It's a big ask. And we're so grateful that we have people like you, such great communicators. And you're so tirelessly moving around the world all of the time, spreading this message and talking to people. And through your charity, through your organization, Mission Blue, we do look forward to seeing those targets met over the next few years, increasing the amount of ocean that is protected. And we'll all be eternally grateful to you for your role in that and for opening our eyes to the great underwater realm and making us all excited about hopefully learning to scuba dive and get down there ourselves. Thank you so much for being on Talking Australia with us today.
Thank you. See you underwater, right?
Hope so.
Okay.
That's it for today's episode of Talking Australia with Dr. Sylvia Earle. If you have questions or comments, feel free to reach out. Write us an email, podcast@australiangeographic.com. find us on Instagram at Australian Geographic. And if you go to australiangeographic.com.au/talkingaustralia, you'll find special offers for our listeners, including 10% off all products purchased in our e-store. So don't wait and go to australiangeographic.com.au/talkingaustralia. Also, make sure to subscribe to the podcast on iTunes, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts from, so you never miss an episode. Thanks for listening. Until next time.